Today, not only how perfectly normal, but also how totally strange it is to be a believer in our culture.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
This is actually the second, obviously, of two episodes where we're talking about the difference between ordinary and extraordinary religion. And I will begin again with a very brief reminder that these are not judgmental terms. They're not even evaluative in the sense of determining that ordinary religion is just plain old religion and who would want that, and extraordinary religion, well, that's really great stuff, or vice versa. It's not to prefer one over the other, but to make clearer to us a sociological truth. And I mentioned Catherine Albanese, the book this came from, before, so I won't go back and rehash all of that. Now, the episode's not from the book, but the underlying idea and distinctions are made on the basis of her conversation about ordinary and extraordinary religion. And so I'm applying it to the culture in ways that are different from that, but I think it might benefit you to look at it in light of what she has said about it. All of that said, we spent the whole first episode talking about ordinary religion and ended up talking about that in the form of religious advocacy for culture, but we probably spent the bulk of the conversation on civil religion. You can go back and listen to that. You can find it at barrycreamer.com. I would encourage you to do that, or just go back as you listen to your podcast here and find the previous episode and listen to that. But where we're picking up today is with extraordinary religion. The way we describe religion as extraordinary is by saying, when we talked about ordinary religion, we said it was how to live well within cultural boundaries. But on extraordinary religion, we're thinking about how to transcend culturally bound life. So living outside the ordinary circle of society, or however you want to describe it, the idea is that you're doing something outside the ordinary, extra ordinary, outside of the way things are, which means that it's not just a reinforcement of the culture built into it in some way. There is a serious questioning of the culture, or simply an escape from or desire to move beyond where the culture is right now, regardless of whether you're actually condemning it or not. And so the first place I would start with extraordinary religion in sort of explaining where the difference lies between that and ordinary religion would be where we are as at least you're receiving this as the first episode of 2022. And that is to recognize what we do with the new year. So just as an illustration of what I'm talking about, if you were to take the way you look at the new year and say, well, what I do at the beginning of January is I retrench, I recover from the holidays, I reestablish the good habits that I had last year, I overcome bad habits that I've developed lately, I look at it and say, well, you know, last year I developed this problem with eating too much chocolate, as I'm watching my producer right now. And this year, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to behave better. I'm going to live within those boundaries that I've had in the past. That would be a form of normal, and that's not religious, obviously. I'm using this as a metaphor for it. But that would be normalized. That would be coming back into the norms of your behavior within the life that you already had established. So that's what I would mean by ordinary religion, where you're just establishing yourself better within the customs, within the culture that you already have. If you look at the new year as an opportunity to quit your job, I'm moving to Afghanistan, I'm taking up a new career, I'm leaving everything behind and starting all over again, that would be using that moment to do something extraordinary. And again, not to place a value on one over the other, but simply to say one is focusing on bringing, supporting the norms that are a part of your life already, and the other is abolishing those or somehow transcending them and doing what no one would expect. So if in February people look at you and say, wow, you really got your life under control now, then you're practicing what would equate to, in the metaphor, ordinary religion. And if people look at you in February and go, what on earth happened to you? What is going on with you? You're not even the same person anymore. Then we'd be talking about the extraordinary, the metaphor for the extraordinary religion that we're talking about. So, you know, what does that look like? In reality, I mean, some of this is, you can put in pejorative terms or you can caricature in sort of a silly way, you know, apocalyptic sandwich sign wearers, you know, the people walking around on the streets back in the Great Depression, the mid-20th century. It was kind of a popular, weird, funny thing. You put a sandwich sign on, you know, I'm talking about the signs on the front and back of the persons draped over your shoulders. You know, the world is about to end. The end of ages is here. You know, repent or whatever. That would be an extraordinary form of religion. You know, the idea that that's comedic actually makes the point that it's an extraordinary form of religion, because the customs of society establish the boundaries within which we think acceptable behavior resides. And when people act outside of those boundaries, we're going to either deny that they're there or get angry with them or laugh at them. We have to do one of those because they don't fit. You can't just shake their hand and say, hey, man, how's it going today? Well, you know, I'm waiting for the fire to fall from heaven, but everything else is all right. I mean, that's just not a normal conversation, right? So the sandwich sign wearers are, you know, a good illustration of what kind of thing we're talking about. And, you know, for me, it's not that difficult to recognize that those sandwich sign wearers are just sort of a more contemporary form of what John the Baptist was in the Gospels. And so it's not, John the Baptist is like, you know, he's my arch hero. I mean, he's the guy. And so I'm certainly not against extraordinary religion. I love the idea of it. And there are a lot of things in ordinary religion that I love as well. But for John the Baptist to be wearing his unusual garb and eating his unusual diet and making his unusual declarations so that people want to come and hear him, but they have to leave Jerusalem, they have to leave the Temple Mount, they have to go down to this river, and they have to be immersed in water that says, I am no longer the person I used to be. I am starting over. All of that tells you how extraordinary that form of religion is, not endorsing the way you used to be, not helping you live better within those norms, but leaving them behind, transcending what you used to be. And, you know, you can tell by the reference to John the Baptist that a lot of this is going to involve what happens when we start thinking about cultural critics. So if we start looking at people who point their finger at society and say, abortion is terrible and you shouldn't be practicing it, racism is awful and you shouldn't be practicing it, immigration has to change and the way we regard foreigners has to change. And, you know, when people are saying things like that about the culture, criticizing the way we live within culture, we might have a tendency to exclude them from the norms of our society automatically. But that would be a mistake. Not all cultural critics are religiously extraordinary. So not all cultural critique is even religious. So joining the other side, meaning, you know, you've been thinking a certain way about the culture, and so you're a Republican, and then you start thinking about being a Democrat, or you're a Democrat, and you start thinking about being a Republican. That doesn't mean you're moving from ordinary to extraordinary religion. In your little circle, people might think you've lost your mind. And so you might think, oh, now I'm being John the Baptist. Now I'm crossing over and having extraordinary religion. That's not what's always happening. It can happen. That can be the case. But it's not what's always happening. It's not even normally what's happening. And there are abundance of illustrations to make this point. But, you know, the easy one for me, I'm 58 years old, the easy one for me is to look back to All in the Family when I was growing up watching it on TV. And Archie Bunker on one side, who is, you know, this sort of ensconcement of normal American life during the 70s from one perspective in that culture. But it is in that culture. And, you know, Archie Bunker's line, you know who I'm talking about in All in the Family. No, you know, no communist is going to burn a flag in my town, kind of. American love and patriotism and, you know, that kind of stuff from his perspective, from his very prejudicial. And, you know, it's obviously being caricatured. I mean, this is Norman Lear, so we know what side Norman Lear was on, but that doesn't matter. The point is that both Archie Bunker and Meathead, and I had to look up his name, Michael Stivic, in the show. Now, you know, obviously, I know it's Carl Reiner, but, I mean, the point is that it's not Rob Reiner, not Carl Reiner. What am I talking about? I'm acting like a fool on Comedians right now. Anyway, it's not, you know, his name in the show, his character's name is Michael Stivic. I never even heard him. I never heard his name referred to that I know of. Maybe Gloria, what's her name's character, referred to it every once in a while. But I always heard Meathead. That's all I ever heard. His statement, you know, his ideology, you know, being the big liberal and the guy who's so much better informed. And yet even in the show, and Norman Lear made this clear in the show, even in the show, they're both just as prejudicial. Archie Bunker is completely judgmental about people like Meathead, who is completely judgmental about people like Archie Bunker. They are just as one-sided each, both of them just on opposite sides of the same culture. So neither one of them is practicing extraordinary anything, and neither one is religious in any way whatsoever in terms of what we are actually talking about today. So, you know, for Meathead, the ideology would be, I don't agree with what you're expressing, but I'll die for your right to express it. That kind of liberal, and I mean it in the technical sense, that's that kind of individualism approach, this respect for whatever view you're going to have, which is what he's supposed to be endorsing. You know, those two sides, neither one reflects a jump from the culture to something that actually transcends the culture itself. For extraordinary religion to happen, there has to be something more than just a change in a person. It's not just, I became better at this or I took a different view of that. This is transcending culturally bound life. This is living outside the ordinary circle of society. And but I will say this, but if you are practicing extraordinary religion, it's very hard to imagine. I haven't been able to. I can't think of an example where this would be the case. But I'll just say it's hard to imagine, because not having found an example yet doesn't mean there's not one. It's hard for me to imagine a cultural defense that doesn't fall under the umbrella of ordinary religion. So let me give this half of the statement first, that when a person is defending the culture and arguing for it, and they're doing it from a religious perspective, then it's going to be ordinary religion. That's what ordinary religion is. And if a person from a religious perspective is questioning the whole of a culture's positioning, where it stands, then that person is practicing extraordinary religion in the language that we're using today. So you get the idea of what I'm talking about. So we have to be kind of careful about how we use the terms. But if we're that careful, then we're at least getting to the right position. So on extraordinary religion now, so how to transcend culturally bound life, there are a couple of examples I would want to give. And the first and the most obvious would be evangelism itself. Just, you know, telling people the good news so that they can become citizens of the kingdom of God and so that their life in eternity will go on in heaven, in the blessings of God, instead of in eternal torment or damnation. The idea of evangelism is about things that happen outside of this culture. And you would have to be a little confused to drag evangelism as something that's about the afterlife. And I'm talking about evangelism where you're talking to people about whether they're going to die and go to heaven or go to hell. That kind of evangelism is inherently extraordinary because it's not about how to live better in this culture. It is about how to escape this culture, how to live in a transcendent reality, how to get there. So, and I'm not saying they're mutually exclusive. You can practice both at the same time in different ways. But in this case, with that kind of evangelism, we'd be talking about something that's extraordinary. The place most of it of us would encounter it would be in those places where it affects our daily ritual, our daily practice of how we live as citizens of a different kingdom. So, for instance, when we're praying, I can remember times when I was in college, and I think college students may have, and I don't, so I, again, I've been in higher education for 21 years now. So, and I mean as a professor, I'm not attending, but as a professor and now president at Criswell College. And so I've been around college students for a long time, and I do think there is, for students who are serious about their Christianity, and I just mean by that they're thinking hard about it and trying to figure out how to practice their religion well, for students like that, I think there is a comeuppance that happens during those college years a lot of times. Sometimes it happens afterwards. I'm not saying it's unique to that, but I see it in a lot of college students where they're having to decide. Am I going to focus on ordinary religion? Am I going to focus on extraordinary religion? And for the students who encounter the transcendent, for students who run into something that they just can't explain psychologically in normal terms, or they can't explain it in normal behavioral terms, or whatever it is, just something powerful happens and they're left in awe by it, there's often a sense that they want to give themselves to that kind, that practice of religion, to the extraordinary side of religion. And I can remember times when I was leading groups in Waco, when I was a student in Waco, as a college student, I didn't really spend a lot of time on my college campus. I spent my time trying to lead a ministry, trying to create a ministry, a church down there. And so I worked with a lot of other college students. I worked with a lot of people who weren't college students but were of that age. And we would meet in every possible way to just try to express our Christianity, meaning live it out. So we would have prayer meetings, for instance, late at night. And I can remember meetings in Waco under a night sky with it completely dark everywhere else and just being overwhelmed by the presence of God in a night sky. It still affects me that I think of being under the night sky in terms of being in the presence of as close as we can get physically to the eternal while we're here in this world. And I think scripture and the heavens are the two things that give us the best sense of what's eternal in this transient world. And so experiencing the transcendental like that, the things that go beyond this world, can be overwhelming and can be a life-altering. And that sort of prayer meeting is something that people experience that is an immediate form of this extraordinary religion. There are also prayers that we would consider completely normal. I'll come back to those in just a moment, and a part of reinforcing the customs of our culture. I'll come back to those in a moment. But this type, you understand what I'm talking about when you have this kind of experience, changes the way you think about the world. I'm not in prayer in those moments so that I can go back to being a good person on the next day, according to my boss. Sort of in a couple of different senses. There's a Freudian sense of it, and then there's a Marxist sense of it, where religion has an inappropriate place controlling people's behavior in the society. That would be describing even extraordinary religion as actually ordinary religion, a way of making people behave in their customs, so the opioid of the masses kind of thing. This is not that. This is, you know, I'm saying a person has these encounters with God that cause them to say, no, my whole life has to be different because I don't just live in a society that defines me. I live in a universe where God defines me and so on like that. We experienced the same things in, morning prayer meetings that I would have in the sanctuary while I was pastoring, and meet at 5:30 in the morning and have these really amazing times of prayer. And I've encountered these since I was in college as well, where you just have times of prayer when you know that things that are happening, interactions that are happening, go beyond. There's something supervenient. It goes beyond the sum of all the parts that are present in that meeting. That kind of transcendence can be overwhelming. For those of you who've never experienced something like that, first of all, I feel, you know, a little sad and sorry for you, but I don't mean that to describe you as pathetic, but I do mean there's something about that that's so powerful. You want people to know what that at least feels like, regardless of what they're going to do with it, so that they know what it could be. It's the same thing, not just with prayer and moments like that, but also with the image, the illustration I gave a moment ago, of baptism. When I was in Waco and I was pastoring that little congregation that I was starting, I can remember going down to the river because we wanted to baptize, and we didn't have a building that had a baptistry in it. So we went down to the river, and it was freezing cold, and, you know, baptized a few people, and it was a huge event. And it's not just the excitement of the event that people are being baptized. It's the image itself. You know, when Abraham is leaving Ur to finally go down to the promised land, he has to cross the rivers, the great rivers, to come into the promised land. This is how Joshua describes it. When Abraham leaves, he has to cross the great river, the great flood. And it's the same thing when Israel is leaving Egypt. They have to cross the great flood. And Paul even brings that into the New Testament, calling it a baptism, baptized unto God. And we ignore this. I've talked about it before on the air when I was doing a radio show. But we ignore this image a lot, but it is perhaps the most important image, or at least the most intrinsic image that's built into baptism, which is that when people crossed bodies of water like that in those days, it was a huge commitment. You weren't going to cross and then cross back. It was a sign that you were moving into a new territory, a new life, and that there was no going back. And that's what baptism is doing. I'm entering a brand new life, and there is no going back. When I come out of this metaphorical body of water, then I'm saying I will never go back to the life I had before I crossed the Red Sea, before I crossed the Jordan River, before I became this person who was committed to God. And so I'm leaving my old life behind, my customs behind, and I am entering into this transcendent life, this life that goes beyond the current world. And I've experienced that with people who've been baptized when they emerge from the water and they just erupt into joy, you know, this weeping happiness that they have. And I know people who, for whom it was just, oh, well, now I'm going to fit into my family better. So it's not always an extraordinary sign. But it often is, and it is a sign that you're entering into that level of commitment. But also, you know, even beyond baptism, all the other images that we have that are associated with the formality of worship, when we have, you know, having stained glass on the outside of a church, or leading from the outside to the inside of a church building, the light that comes into the building then is filtered through these colors and patterns that lend a sense of holiness or reverence to what's going on inside, the smell of incense. I'm not saying that I have incense in my church, but I'm saying the people who do that are doing it for this reason, the reason some priests are wearing robes and mitres that other people make fun of and say, oh, that looks so ridiculous. Well, the whole point of it is that it doesn't fit into the customs of society. The more ridiculous, the better. In terms of saying, I'm not one of you. I am John the Baptist out in the wilderness, you know? So that's the whole idea of what otherwise would be considered absurd, that it doesn't fit the society. That's when you're starting to see people who are committed to, or at least expressing, an extraordinary form of religion. And I need to mention here on the way to what we're talking about next, the challenge that comes here. Is that the if you really want to practice extraordinary religion, some people do, some people don't. Again, I'm not picking a side on which one's better than the other. I think there's value that each brings depending on where the culture is. But if you're practicing extraordinary religion, the challenge is that the more you practice those things that are a part of your extraordinary religion, the more they become part of your enculturation. They become the normal part of your life. So that's what's happened with the way Sunday morning worship happens. When you're in a culture where nobody goes to church and you go on Sunday morning and you're the person who gets up early on Sunday and everybody else is still in bed and you're the person who comes back from church on Sunday to have your lunch and everybody else is already at the restaurant and you're the weirdo, you know, who was going to church and nobody else is going to church, then it's extraordinary religion, lo and behold. But as you grow that church and as more and more of your neighbors are coming to the church with you and as they have their kids and they participate in the church, and lo and behold, before long, there's only one person who doesn't come to church on Sunday morning, a few generations into that, and going to church is just the cultural thing to do. It's just the normal thing to do. That doesn't mean it doesn't have value. It doesn't mean it can't be holy or sanctified, but it does mean it's no longer extraordinary. It's not challenging the norms of the culture. It's actually establishing the norms of the culture. Prayer is the same way. If you pray every night under a night sky, then eventually it's very difficult to maintain the sense of transcendence instead of normalcy that automatically follows when you do something over and over and over again. It becomes your pattern of behavior. And if your group goes out to pray that way every single night, then it becomes the ordinary practice of the custom that you have established as a social group. And that becomes normal. So prayers at mealtime, a lot of times, have become that. The idea that we would be so different from the world that every time we sit down to a meal, we would remember to thank God, because every gift of God is good and every creature has been given by him so that we can enjoy it, you know, as Paul teaches Timothy. The fact that we would do that in such an extraordinary way is fantastic. The fact that it would become so enculturated that you might look askance at somebody if they forget to say their prayer before they eat their meal tells you that it has become ordinary. And again, that's not a pejorative term. We're using it technically in the sense of ordinary or extraordinary religion, not about whether you ought to do it or not, but just which category it fits in. And this becomes a real challenge for people who want to maintain a sense of the extraordinary but have actually done it for so long that it has become the ordinary. And this is a challenge that every generation has when they're passing down a transcendent type of religion to their own children. How are their children not going to experience that as the custom when that's what their parents have taught them their entire lives? And so if the only value you give to it is ordinary, extraordinary, that's a different challenge altogether. So I'm not saying even that. These are analytic categories. So that when we're looking at other people and saying, or looking at ourselves and saying, why do I practice my Christianity that way? Why am I so threatened by this or that kind of statement from the pulpit? That we can recognize it may be because it's challenging what we actually believe doctrinally about our Christianity, or it may be that they're simply challenging the part of the culture we thought they ought to reinforce. And it doesn't have anything to do with our religion, with the genuine doctrine of our religion. So you can hear how important this could become. And so I want to point out a few of the places where we have a crossover. And some are silly. I mean, one example I'll give is silly in this. But a place where they sort of cross over, where there is a melding between the ordinary and the extraordinary. On the very odd side of where you can see a melding between ordinary and extraordinary religion. And this is odd. I mean, this is a group that I don't think any of us would identify with other than having seen them on the news and saying, what happens when a person falls into something like this? On the very odd side, there's that really extreme QAnon, and I didn't do any research on this. I'm just basing it on the news stories that I've seen about it. I don't know anything else about it. So on a very light examination, there's this extreme QAnon, not the whole QAnon movement, which I disavow entirely, but this very extreme smaller QAnon John F. Kennedy Jr. group, you know, in Dallas that's been there for a long time now, for several months now, and have, you know, this one unifying leader that they're rallying around and things like that. I don't even know if they're still meeting down there anymore by Thanksgiving Square sometimes and down near where John F. Kennedy was shot. But, you know, they're consummately extraordinary. I mean, they're awaiting a second coming of a messianic figure. They are awaiting the second coming of JFK Jr., the son who died in the plane crash. They believe he's going to come back. It's going to turn out that he's alive and he's going to reappear. Again, I'm just reading the stories and telling you what they say. So these people are meeting and they believe it. JFK Jr. is going to show up again. But they're also, and that's extraordinary. You know, he's going to rise from the dead, or it's going to turn out that he was somehow holed up somewhere, still alive, or whatever it is. It's going to be this miraculous reappearance of John F. Kennedy Jr. But then they are consummately ordinary as well. This is what I mean by melding the two together, because what they believe that second coming would bring is a reinstatement of Donald Trump as the president, making America great again. Now, I'm not even getting on the Trump wagon and talking about criticizing it being anti-Trump, or getting on the wagon and saying you ought to promote Trump. I don't care about any of that today in this discussion. We can have those discussions other days. But for this, that is a melding between extraordinary and ordinary religion that's hard to exaggerate. I mean, it is held together with such tension, I can't even believe it can stay together. We are waiting for a miraculous reappearance of a messianic figure of Democratic proportions, by the way, of John F. Kennedy Jr., so that Donald Trump will be miraculously reinstated as president during the Biden administration. It's just, my head wants to explode when I hear things like that, partially because the extraordinary part is so weird, but partially because of the belief that you could combine that with this sort of naturalistic view of what the betterment of America would be about if this thing were to happen politically, that would solve all of our problems, or at least that it would lead in a better direction, it's hard to even comprehend. So there's an example of where there is a melding of an ordinary and extraordinary religion. But there are also ways that because we've blended together our ordinary religion with our culture, deeply in our culture, and in some ways have tried to make it sound like, no, we're trying to leave the culture behind and not be as corrupt as this culture. And so at least trying to make it sound like we're extraordinary in our religious practice, that we end up obscuring some ethical mistakes. And some of these topics are sensitive. So I'm not trying to attack, and these would be things that would merit a longer discussion, which I hope for us to have in the future. But just grasp the example that I'm giving you. So one example of this would be regarding sexuality, regarding the way we have over the life of our country, but certainly over the last 50 years since the sexual revolution, which is actually 60 years ago now, the way we have used the terms promise keepers or love can wait, or established what people call pejoratively a purity culture, or the Billy Graham rule, you know, the rule that you can't meet with a woman by herself. There is something underlying those things, which is ordinary. Like, oh, no, we have to preserve the norms of society and maintain the respect for marriage that should go with it. That would make it ordinary religion. There is a part of it that says, oh, our whole culture is given over to the sexual revolution and all the things from the 1960s, and we're going to be different from that and transcend our culture. And so there's a way in which it can be defended as extraordinary. And some of the experiences, some of the stadium meetings and the raucous crowds supporting the causes have seemed more like extraordinary religion than ordinary religion. But in all of those has been lost something that's happening that I don't think we've paid close attention to. And again, this would be an entire show that we don't have time to do right now, but where we end up actually blaming women for any sexual promiscuity or any temptations that happen in the culture, and considering women inherently dangerous in some way, while at the same time excusing men, not saying they can do whatever they want to do, but saying, oh, well, I mean, how are they going to help it? I mean, look at those billboards and the signs that are out there. And so we end up establishing rules on the basis that men cannot be held capable of restraining themselves. Now, that doesn't mean they can't be held responsible for what they've done, but we knew they couldn't restrain themselves because, I mean, look at the temptations that were facing them. I mean, what did you expect? And ethical dilemma, it's not actually a dilemma, that ethical problem that we have, blaming one gender while excusing the other gender, gently excusing the other gender, is a blindness that we have because we think we're just reinforcing our religious commitment to the things, for instance, that Solomon taught, as if the description that's given in Solomon about the dangerous woman is of a woman who smiles at you or has a meal with you. She's not, you know, in Proverbs. We'll come back and talk about it another time, but I mean, this is a completely different person who's very overt in the offers that she makes. That's a completely different subject matter than saying, oh, be careful about even being around the female sex because those people are dangerous over there. You know, we tolerate an attitude because we're not paying attention to it because we think it's religious when in reality it's just cultural. It's cultural on one side because it's normative. It's cultural on the other side because it's sort of countercultural, but it's still in the culture. And we tolerate, therefore, this attitude toward women, which is a lot more Islamic than it is Christian, because we've been enculturated in it. I think the first time I ever heard that if a Muslim woman was raped, she was held responsible for that, that she was the person who was excluded from her family and excluded from marriage and excluded from the society and so on. And the men weren't. They weren't treated that way because it was her responsibility that it happened. I was just floored. My jaw was on the ground. And then I realized over time the parallels between that and the way we regard women in our very religious culture, sometimes extraordinary, sometimes ordinary religion, blinds us to the ethical responsibilities we have to regard each other with equal dignity, and we just don't notice it. So again, I'll do a whole show on that another time because I think it's worth a conversation for us to take more responsibility for maintaining an ethic in which we recognize the inherent dignity that belongs to each person in that equation. But that's a discussion for another day. You know, in terms of how this has come to be played out in our society, for instance, in, our ordinary religion making things normal for us, ordinary for us, making things a part of the culture for us, ordinary religion can convey or enforce mores like we were talking about above when we were talking about ordinary religion and how there's civil religion, but then there's also religious efforts to reinforce cultural norms. A lot of dietary rules are related to that. And so the way, not all of them, and in America, we have certainly secularized a lot of this over time, but the idea that we would never eat a horse but would eat a pig has for some people the same weight of value that their religion has for them. I mean, why on earth would anybody eat a dog, for instance? And I just can't believe those people. I mean, what kind of creatures could they be that they would eat their dog and then we eat a pig? And I'm choosing pig because it's unclean in the Old Testament and because some people would not eat that. But I'm using it to make the point that there's nothing in our religion that could distinguish between a dog and a pig as being clean or unclean, and yet we've so normalized it that it almost feels like a violation of some rule, some ethic that's so deep-seated that if it's not built into our religion, we'd sort of like for it to be built into our religion. Well, I'm not going to eat that horse because, you know, in the Old Testament it says don't eat an animal if its hoofs are not cloven, you know, or if it doesn't chew the cud. That's not why it is, but we might use that to reinforce what we're doing, even with the way we wash our hands, and you can get into that on your own. Or looking at our holidays, you know, can sort of reinforcing our mores. So when, for instance, when we have a Thanksgiving holiday, we're talking about a very secular holiday. I'm not saying we don't thank God or that it wasn't originated with the idea of thanking God, but it is a holiday entirely rooted in helping us as a nation. A nation in history, look at our history and say, wow, we should be grateful to be the nation that we are. And so, I mean, it's established as a national holiday during the Civil War for that purpose. Our whole country should have a reason to be thankful with each other. This is inherently tied to civil religion, to understanding the sacredness of our civil society. You put that holiday, I mean, these are the two big holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas. You put that holiday next to Christmas and you see the other half where we say, oh, now we're going to buy gifts and we're going to have put up the lights and everybody's going to have a Christmas sign. And even the people who don't go to church know that we celebrate Christmas on December 25th. That's the day Jesus is born. And people who don't have any belief in God whatsoever are singing Handel's Messiah. I mean, why is that happening? Because we also have these traditions that are built into our normal practices that where religion is at the center of it. So recognizing that those are present doesn't condemn one and bless the other, but it does give us a tool for starting to peel out these fine truths about what's right or wrong in our own practices or right or wrong about our own judgments when we're looking at how other people are practicing their lives and when we're looking at how we are practicing our Christianity. Even if you look at where America is going right now, you can see where these differences have started to play out. I remember when every wedding was in a church, and if you didn't, it was because you were in a rush or because they wouldn't do it. And so you had to go to a justice of the peace. Wedding venues are now replacing churches. They are replacing sanctuaries or chapels. You go out and you buy, you know, some, you know, at a winery. You go rent a big room and you have your reception the same place you have your wedding, or you do it outdoors or whatever. All of that should give you some sense of where religion does or doesn't fit where it used to in our society regarding both sides, ordinary and extraordinary religion. Inviting the pastor into that setting allows religion to occupy this slightly more extraordinary place. Oh, well, we're out in this winery having our wedding, but we did invite this guy who wears funny clothes and is going to pronounce funny words over us so that we can remember that this is something being given to us from heaven. The same with funerals, by the way. Every funeral needed to be in a church a long time ago. Now, not so much. I mean, a lot of funerals are only graveside. No, I have no condemnation for this at all. I really prefer graveside services. So I'm just expressing what's happening in the culture where people used to need to have their service in the church. I mean, I remember over and over people coming to me as a pastor and saying, oh no, Daddy's got to have his service in the church. He loved that church. He was in that church. And people need to know he was in the church. And that's just not the case. I mean, very rarely does that happen anymore. Not saying there are no church services, but I'm saying very rarely is it necessary to have it in the church like we used to have it in the church. And the same thing is happening in so many ways. If you're watching television, you're not going to be watching shows about angels. This is not, the great Christmas movies that we loved from old. If you're watching a show on TV now, it's not going to be about priests or churches. It's going to be about doctors and hospitals or about police and the workplaces and homes that the police have, because that's how we view a rupture in our society right now, not as a spiritual thing. And so I'm saying with that there's room for both ordinary and extraordinary religion where it's actually being excluded in the practices that we have right now. So, you know, let me explain what this awareness should mean for us from my perspective. First, there's recognizing that there is more to withdrawing to the Benedictine option, you know, or to engagement that we might realize, because withdrawing from culture entails a commitment to extraordinary religion. It carries the challenge that the features of the culture exist for a reason that may not be good, and it comes to challenge those features of the culture. The churches that don't want... So I've seen churches try to do this. They'll start up a church and they will say, well, we're not going to do all the normal stuff that churches do. We're not going to have a nursery. We're not going to do all those. We're not going to have a committee. We're not going to do any of that stuff. And then, you know, young couple that helped start the church has a baby and it's like, somebody's got to watch this kid while we're having church. And suddenly they need a nursery and they become normal again. So recognizing that there's more to withdrawing from the culture, and that when you do withdraw from a culture, you're doing it on the basis, I mean, I'm saying in a religious sense, you're doing it on the basis of your extraordinary religion, but you should also recognize that that's going to be difficult. If you eat and share space with other people, no matter how supernatural your commitments are, nature's going to creep back in because you're fighting over space. And it doesn't mean you're literally fighting, but you know what I mean? You can, even if you're being gentle about it, when you move into a space, you are preventing another person from moving into that space. You get the idea. The commitment in the same way, recognizing there's more to withdrawal, this part of the conversation, the commitment to culture, so withdrawal from culture entails a commitment to extraordinary religion. A commitment to culture entails a commitment to ordinary religion, because religion will enculturate you. It will help reinforce the culture, or you wouldn't be willing to commit to the culture. And so the challenge there is that religion necessarily becomes customized. It becomes a part of the customs of the culture, so it becomes fit to the culture that you're in. And I mean the term ambiguously, the term customized. It becomes customized to your culture. That's part of the reason that 20th century missionaries realized they were exporting their culture along with, or sometimes even more significantly than or in place of, their religion. And then they looked back at it and said, oh, we got to stop doing that. We have to figure out what the essence of the gospel is and not just ask people to become Americans so that they can become Christian and so on. That's a part of recognizing the difference between the extraordinary side and the ordinary side of religion. Not condemning all the ordinary part of it, but recognizing the difference between the two. So number one is recognizing that there's more to withdrawal or to engagement, either one, than we might realize. Second is recognizing the difference between affirming and defending culture and then affirming and defending your faith. So there has to be a willingness for us to accept the flaws and failures of our culture. If we're going to be believers of any kind, we have to be willing to do that. And so we have to recognize that any criticism of a culture, any criticism of a nationality and their founding is, you know, can be taken as unseemly. Are you not grateful for who we are? But recognizing the value of what might be in that recognition is fundamental to being a person who's willing to listen to God instead of just our culture. So something like the 1619 Project, with its flaws, with its errors built into it, also might have a word of insight for us that we should be willing to consider as we look at the value of religion, both ordinary and extraordinary. And then finally, we have to clarify the priority of our commitment to the kingdom of God above everything else, knowing this, that we will never be completely perfect. Not until we see Jesus. We're just never going to be completely perfect, including in this culture. So it should not shock us, since we know we'll never be completely perfect, it should not shock us that we are never disentangled from our culture with its blessings and with its curses. But we can be committed to refreshing our walk every day as people who are willing to say, "Our Father in heaven, may your name be hallowed. May your will be done. May your kingdom come."
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.